seated, please. First case on our calendar is 98-15-86, State of Ohio versus Ulysses Murphy.
May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice, Associate Justices of this court. Again, my name is Joe Edwards, and I will be arguing Mr. Murphy's brief on behalf of defendant appellant. It's far lawful to say again, good morning. I would like to reserve 6 minutes for the clock.
I'm ready to talk.
The defendant appellant would like to address two of the issues raised in Mr. Murphy's merit brief this morning. Obviously, prepared to address other issues that the court would deem those relevant. The two issues in reverse chronological order. First off, we're dealing with the penalty phase jury instructions. The second issue, we're dealing with the court overruling the defense motion to suppress the statement which took place during trial or during the pretrial hearing and likewise was admitted during trial against the defendant appellant. Phase jury instructions. Mr. Murphy urges his court to vacate his death sentence, primarily because these jury instructions are probably sentenced. This court, hearing post-Lockett cases beginning with State versus Jenkins back in the early 80s, these instructions are probably the worst that any court, that any defense attorney has ever submitted in this state. When these instructions were submitted to the jury in this case, Mr. Murphy was inextricably linked to a sentence and to a verdict of death. These instructions totally confused the burden of proof. They presumed that a death sentence should be awarded. The instructions improper language was permeated throughout these instructions. And whether this is a claim of plain error, the trial court gave these instructions, or whether or not this is a situation where, and we think probably a better argument is that this is ineffective assistance of counsel, these instructions are so bad, are so erroneous, are so inconsistent with post-Lockett jurisprudence this court has handed down that necessitates a reversal. I would contrast this case with the case of State versus Stallings, which this court decided back in July of this year. In the majority opinion in State versus Stallings, this court was very concerned that in the voir dire process, the judge and the attorneys, both the defense counsel as well as the prosecutor, were mixing up the semantics. That during the voir dire, when individual voir dire was taking place in Stallings, apparently counsel and the judge were saying, well, to get a life sentence, the mitigation has to outweigh, the mitigating factors have to outweigh the aggravating circumstance. And the trial court, or the majority opinion in this case, specifically said, although referring to mitigation outweighing aggravating circumstances is a common semantic mistake, it could, under other circumstances, constitute fatal error. Now, the difference between what happened in Stallings in this case, that in Stallings, by the time the case got to the penalty phase, the court had cured the error by giving the jury proper penalty phase instructions. In this case, the opposite took place. The court, using instructions which were submitted by my client's trial counsel, gave the jury completely erroneous instructions. For example, when you get to the heart and soul of the instructions, where the court is summarizing the weighing process, the court on two separate occasions states that the mitigating factors must outweigh the aggravating circumstance for a life sentence to be imposed. This is clearly erroneous, and this is completely different from what happened in Stallings. Because in Stallings, again, the error arguably was cured by the time the penalty instructions were given. And what is even worse in this case, as we argue in our brief, is that the verdict forms do not cure the instructions. The verdict forms just say something effective, We, the jury, being duly impaneled and sworn, hereby recommend a sentence of death or a sentence of life without parole 30 years, life without parole 25 years. So it's very clear that this is the type of fatal error that the majority decision in State v. Stallings was discussing. And there are numerous other fatal errors that occur in these instructions. For example, in the early part of the instructions, the court defines aggravating circumstance as something that makes the defendant's crime more serious, makes the death penalty more appropriate than a sentence of life in prison. And our argument, our position, as we argue and we set forth in our brief, that statement presumes that the jury should return a verdict of death. Now, we don't know that without the court or without the jury finding during the first phase that there is beyond reasonable doubt that an aggravating circumstance exists, the jury would never get to the penalty phase. And in this instruction, when the court tells the jury that because you have found an aggravating circumstance, it makes the death penalty more appropriate, well, that's absolutely not true. Because when you get to the penalty phase, the balancing at the beginning is at least equal. And that it's only if the aggravating circumstances outweigh the mitigating factors beyond a reasonable doubt is a sentence of death warranted. We would submit, as we already in our brief, that instruction in of itself negates reversal of this case because it mandates, it presumes a sentence of death. Another problem the court had was...
Counsel, though, I mean, that I'm certainly not... asking the question because I'm supporting the mistake here, but the but your argument seems to would require us to give no importance or take no account of the additional instructions the court was giving. You know, at some point the jurors understood that they were nevertheless to look at, you know, three choices of sentence. So, I mean, that also pervades the penalty phase instructions. I mean, to accept your position would really obviate all that, all the other instructions that the jurors were given. I'm not saying that your point isn't well taken, that appears to be significant error in the instructing, but to take it to the level that you want to say, which is to tell the jurors that they must presume the death penalty, it would make us ask us to kind of give no weight at all to the balance of the instructions that did say to the jurors, here's your task.
I understand that there is case after case from this court and the appellate courts throughout the state that the jury, the instructions are to be read as a whole. And again, obviously, the defendant appellant's position in this case is that description of the aggravating circumstance is done by the trial court very early on in the instructions. It kind of sets the tenor of the instructions. And again, it's clear the jury understood that there were choices in this case. But the question becomes is, with that type of definition of aggravating circumstance, did the jury understand that the choices were all equal? Did the jury understand that they were to do a balancing? Or did the jury rather understand that because they had returned a guilty verdict, because they had made a finding that an aggravating circumstance exists, that as a result, they were to give more weight to that aggravating circumstance, and as a result, they were to lean more heavily towards a verdict of death? And obviously, that's our concern, and I think that it continues when the court defines mitigating factors as the opposite of aggravating circumstances. And I think that maybe as lawyers who handle these cases, I think that I can understand perhaps maybe where the court was coming from. I would again argue that instruction is very, very confusing, because if you think of mitigating factors being the opposite of the aggravating circumstance, in this case, you have what trial counsel normally call the 8-7 specification, that the aggravated murder was committed during the course of conduct of committing an aggravated robbery. So if the aggravated robbery is the aggravating circumstance, and if the mitigating factors are the opposite of that, what does that really mean? Does it mean that it's the opposite of aggravated robbery, which means that mitigating factors are whatever was presented during the penalty phase of the trial, which negates the defendant's culpability in the offense? Now, we all understand that the nature and circumstances of the offense can be mitigating factors, but it would appear by defining mitigating factors as the opposite of the aggravating circumstance, the court is kind of directing the jury that, you know, you're not supposed to look at all this testimony from social workers, the defendant's upbringing, the fact that he was raised by alcoholic parents, that he had no nurture and love, that you're supposed to look rather at what negates his culpability in the offense. And again, this is clearly erroneous. It is in direct opposition to Lockett versus Ohio. And in all the cases this court has decided, it states that the jury has to look at the individual defendant. There has to be a narrowing before a verdict of death can be returned. And again, this focuses, really, it's almost as if this is a trial-based instruction. It's looking at the defendant's culpability rather than what we have all learned and have become to know is what exactly mitigation and mitigating factors are. And again, I would just say that the two points in time, they're on page, I think, volume 12, pages 1574 and 1576, where the court really gets to the heart and soul of the instructions. When the court is summarizing the instructions, again, the court says that the only way, and again, I'm paraphrasing, but I think for the most part it's accurate, that the only way a verdict, of life should be returned is if the mitigating factors outweigh the aggravating circumstance beyond a reasonable doubt. And again, I think this is so contrary to Ohio law, and it's clearly in direct contrast with State v. Stallings. And I can understand this court's decision, the majority decision in Stallings, that by the time you got to the penalty phase, the problem with the semantic reversal was correct. However, in this case, Mr. Murphy was not afforded that opportunity. So I would, our position is, this is clearly outcome determinative error. This is clearly either plain error, and I realize that time again, this court has stated that plain error is to be determined very cautiously, only in very, very rare circumstances. And I would just, our position is that this should be one of these rare circumstances. This should be one of those cautious moments where plain error is decided because the instructions are so erroneous. On the other hand, it is clear that for a defense attorney, for trial counsel, to present these instructions, to not object to these instructions where the death verdict with these instructions is always a certainty, where there was very, very valuable and very relevant mitigation, there's no sound tactical advantage to submit these instructions, none whatsoever. I realize, I believe in the state's brief, there's a discussion of invited error. Our response would simply be that we understand the invited error doctrine, and I know that recently the case of State versus Bay, BEY, this court discussed that issue dealing with the jury instruction. However, I think in State versus Bay, this court found that the instruction that defense counsel submitted, it dealt with other acts, and that the other acts should only be relevant for purposes of identification. I think this court clearly stated that was instruction that is routinely given in trial courts. So as a result, I think this court is a little bit more comfortable in not finding that was an ineffective assistance of counsel claim because the instruction was not erroneous, and it was a standard instruction. These are not standard instructions. These are, again, I feel I can be very confident standing before this court that these are most likely the worst set of penalty phase instructions that the defense has ever seen in the post-Lockett era. They totally forego any concept of mitigation and what Lockett stands for. The other issue I would like to discuss deals with the Miranda issue, which we argued in volume one of our brief, our first two or three assignments of error. We think there's a significant question of whether or not the defendant knowingly, voluntarily, intelligently waived his right to counsel. I had an opportunity to review the videotape, and it appears as if the detective read Mr. Murphy his rights. It took under 3 minutes. The detective had the constitutional rights waiver form. He took it, he kind of reversed it in front of Mr. Murphy. This is very clear on the tape. And it appears as if the detective reads the standard Miranda warnings to Mr. Murphy. And then, and again, the tape is difficult to hear at times, but it appears as if Mr. Murphy then reads out loud the rights waiver. At the moment he ends his reading of the rights waiver, the detective begins by saying something to the effect of, well, you know, I really can't counsel you, I really can't tell you what to do, but we're really interested in getting your side of the story. And Mr. Murphy does not sign the rights waiver, but more importantly, because we understand there is case law that says you don't have to have a signature on the rights waiver portion of the form to show that there is a valid waiver, but we also understand that the state has a burden of proof by preponderance of the evidence to show that there is a valid waiver of the defendant's Fifth Amendment rights. And it would appear as if the detective in this situation never once asked the defendant, you know, do you understand your rights? Are you willing to waive your rights? Are you willing to sign this form? But instead just begins by questioning him. We think that, and our position is, that is not a valid rights waiver. And secondly, and more importantly, it appears as if 10 minutes into the interview, and I believe this took place on the videotape at approximately 10:56:54 or something around there, where the defendant blurts out to the detective, I'm ready to quit talking. And our position is that is a clear, unambiguous request to cease the interview. It is a request to remain silent, stop the procedure, and that under Miranda versus Arizona, that same time, law enforcement must cease the questioning. In fact, at that point in time, it was clear, it was so clear to the detective what my client was doing is that the detective from the Columbus Police Department simply said, okay, he gathered up his notes and he left the room and came back approximately, I think, 5 or 10 minutes later, I'm not sure the exact time, he came in with another detective and the other detective kind of goes into this very long soliloquy for about 5 minutes and then begins questioning Mr. Murphy. They never read him his rights again. They never ask him whether he's willing to waive his rights. And again, we believe that the statement, I'm ready to quit talking, is clear, it's unambiguous, it's unequivocal. He was requesting to stop the interview process, and instead, the law enforcement officers in this case clearly violated the tenets of Miranda versus Arizona by continuing to question him regarding this issue. And we believe that this error is prejudicial. Obviously, it's constitutional error. And our position is obviously from this court that constitutional error can occur, that that regardless of the evidence that comes in, there's other significant compelling evidence of the defendant's guilt. And in our brief, we discuss in detail the fact that the only other evidence, I don't believe there's any physical evidence that actually links Mr. Murphy to this offense, but rather it is the sister of the decedent who identified Mr. Murphy while she was sitting in a car. Apparently the shooting took place behind the car, outside of a after-hours club here in Franklin County.
Counselor, we've read the briefs and we understand the rear-view mirror and the chains and all of that. And I think you have some really important legal issues here that was certainly one that I'd like to discuss, and I'd just like to know when you get to that point, if you're finished with the two assignments you're talking about now or getting close.
I was right there. I was just talking about the Constitution over there, just to summarize the last point.
That's why I interrupted you at that time, because it sounded to me like you were winding down on that issue. I'd like to go to your proposition of law number 7, and I do it specifically because I want the prosecutor to hear what my questions are of you. Your proposition of law number 7, do you have that in front of you? It's on page 32 of your brief.
Thank you, Your Honor.
No, it's on page 32 of the appellee's brief. It's on page...
28.
28 of your brief, yes, sir. Okay. Do I understand the facts correctly that the jury was impaneled, that alternate juries were impaneled, and alternate jurors were impaneled, and then after the conclusion of the guilt stage, all of the jurors, including the alternates, went into the jury room. Is that accurate?
That's my understanding, yes, Your Honor.
Is it also accurate that at the end of the penalty stage, that all of the jurors, including the alternates, again went into the jury room?
Your Honor, again, that is my understanding, yes.
Okay, now that's what I can find. Well, I've had time to go over the record on this. It seems to me that that's what happens. You just make that allegation, and it seems to me the state, you make that assertion, and it seems to me the state concurs in that, but I want to be sure before I ask the next question that that's what happened.
Your Honor, that's my understanding.
Okay.
Yes.
Your main argument here, I would think, I understand the questions of voir dire and the questions that you're raising with regard to Miranda and all of that. But that's all summed up, is it not, in the instruction issue that you argue in ineffective assistance of counsel?
I would think, Your Honor, yes, that is correct.
Okay. In this case, is it fair to say that Criminal Rule 24 was clearly violated?
It would appear so, Your Honor, yes.
And there was no objection to that by the defense counsel?
None whatsoever.
All right. You seem to concede that we, in a clearly well-reasoned opinion by the Chief Justice in State v. Hutton, controls this situation. Does it? All right, let me refresh your recollection, because I see a little quizzical look. In Hutton, as I recall it, what happened was after the penalty phase, then somebody got sick on the jury or something, and the court substituted a juror then into the penalty phase, into that jury. That's not what happened here, is it?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe so.
Then is Hutton controlling authority? What you say Hutton says is, at least as the way I read your brief, and certainly I read the state's brief that way, that Hutton provides that in capital cases, in effect, Rule 24 is inoperable. And I don't think Hutton says that. And I'm wondering why you would concede that Hutton, which was a clearly different factual situation, especially given our most recent pronouncements on alternate jurors don't go into a jury room, period. If they do, case is reversed. I mean, we've done that, I think, recently in two cases, because the rule is so clear. And the rule very clearly says that they should be discharged, doesn't it?
That's correct, Your Honor. In fact, I think I reviewed one of the recent cases as worth of that was a civil case. I don't know the name of it. I believe I reviewed the case, but it would not appear to me, and if that was our position in our brief, it appears that may not be accurate, because it does not appear as if State versus Hutton could be used on behalf of the states or what's close here.
But well,
in that situation, you specifically say, and it's not on 28, it's after that in your brief. It's on 52, I think. Yeah, you're on page. Go to page 52. All right, let's assume that's where you are with Proposition Law Number 7. Now, let's assume for a minute that the rule is clear and was violated and no objection. Waiver?
Well, I think that...
Is it plain error?
For from the review of our proposition, a lot of the cases we cite, obviously our position would be plain error because of the potential prejudice that could result from the alternate jurors being there. I think at the same time, perhaps, it sheds further light on the fact that there was this ineffective assistance of counsel that permeated what took place both during the trial and during the penalty phase.
Okay. Now, it seems to me your argument thus far has been, and I know a lawyer never concedes guilt, but you're really arguing the penalty phase for the most part. So if we found that to be a, quote, fatal, not to make a pun, fatal error here, would the proper procedure be to remand it back to the trial court for sentencing pursuant to the new constitutional provision, life imprisonment without parole?
And you're talking about the penalty phase instruction hearing, Your Honor?
I'm talking about, it doesn't seem to me that you're saying that there was substantial argument that wasn't either waived or can't be explained away in the guilt phase. Now, if you're, are you arguing the guilt phase here today?
With regard to the first argument raised in Volume 1 dealing with the Miranda issue, we would argue that his statement coming in was fatal error, it was outcome determined there.
So you think this case should be tried over?
Yes, Your Honor.
But counsel, you only raised that issue in the under the ineffective assistance of counsel provision. The juror going in there, isn't it only an ineffective assistance of counsel claim? Well, allowing alternates in there. I thought that you conceded you only raised that issue as under the rubric of ineffective assistance.
I don't believe that's true, because I think on Volume 1, page 52, our seventh composition of law, I think that it's raised when the trial court allows the alternate jurors. I think it's raised as a plain error, the trial court allowed that
okay.
to take place.
And the standard for plain error is more than, you know, it's not that the rule was clearly violated. We still have to review it under the standard of review for plain error, which really essentially boils down to it has to be some error that would enter into the trust of courts. And in as much as we have nothing to support that there was any prejudice, I mean, we have the potential, but so under a plain error review, can you really tell us that there's anything there for plain error?
Your Honor, obviously that's one of our concerns, is that if in fact this criminal rule was violated, other than just the mere fact that the jurors, the alternates, are back there during the deliberation, it would appear as if on direct appeal, or perhaps on post-conviction or federal habeas, that perhaps the record could be extended, but it would seem to me that there's nothing directly in the record to show inherent prejudice, which is a difficult.
Right.
So which is why this maybe it kind of connects up to these.
But nevertheless, that is the standard of review for plain error. It's not that the rule plainly was violated. Plain error is the standard of review.
I believe so. I see that my time is way over. We've got 2 minutes left. Thank you very much.
Let me just ask you back to the Hutton issue, the juror, the alternate who was in the jury room. Can you think of any strategic reason that the defense counsel would want to have an alternate juror in the jury room where the alternate juror is not replacing a juror?
You're right. I can see no reason why defense counsel would want any one of the 12 jurors that are deliberating on the case. In fact, I think that there are other ways this can be done. In fact, I think they routinely, the alternate jurors are kept, say for example, in the courthouse, but they're kept in a separate location where they're not actually part of the deliberating process. So therefore, if something would happen, perhaps it would be replaced, between the two phases. But it would seem to me that there would be no sound package of decisions to why counsel would want alternates back there while the jury's deliberating in either case.
Yeah, it's the judge's
place. Thank you.
Of course it is.
Good day.
It's mandatory.
With respect to, I'm sorry, I'm not quite sure where I should begin here.
Well, perhaps you can begin with the first argument, which was that...
With the instruction.
The instruction with respect to mitigating circumstances, which is all about. You stress in your brief that that instruction is essentially defense counsel's submitted instruction with monitor.
And the mayor.
Defense counsel here was in the trial.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
Who was the defense lawyer?
Oh, Terry Sherman and Deborah Burrell.
Were they experienced? Definitely.
Oh, absolutely, yes, Your Honor. I think that even Mr. Edwards would be more than willing to concede that Mr. Sherman's very experienced in death penalty litigation on both sides of the fence.
What's your take on this instruction? Have you ever seen an instruction like this?
No, but my take on these instructions, I can understand very well why a defense attorney might want these instructions. First of all, Mr. Edwards states the instruction on page 1574 where the court says, if you find the mitigating circumstances outweighing the aggravating circumstances, you must return the verdict to life imprisonment. He characterizes that as saying that that was the only way that they could return to death, life imprisonment. And that's clearly not the case. The court goes through on that page four, she said there are four options here. You have to think of four things. One, if you find the aggravating circumstances outweigh the mitigating circumstances, you must return the death verdict. The second is if you find, that the mitigating circumstances outweigh the aggravating circumstances, you must return a verdict of life imprisonment. If you find that the mitigating factors and the aggravating circumstances are equal, then you must return a verdict of life imprisonment. If you can't make up your mind whether or not one outweighs the other or whether they are equal, then you must return a verdict of life imprisonment. I think the effect of this was to give the jury, here's one place, one area where you can find, where you can impose a death verdict, but look at all these options where you must return a verdict of life imprisonment. It's almost kind of rhythmic in its insistence. So I don't see, looking at those instructions as a whole, how you can find that they were prejudicial.
Did the prosecution object right now?
No, the prosecution did not. And,
I got it here.
The prosecution did not object to those instructions.
But they are, you indicated, unusual or unorthodox.
Oh, I believe, yes. I think they're extraordinary. I wish the prosecutor did object to these instructions.
So,
but I do not believe...
So, advocates on both sides at this level are in the same position. Both of them. There have been an objection to these instructions.
I think that they were highly slanted towards the defense. I don't think that you can go through these instructions.
The question is, do they follow the law?
But if the defense attorney...
If they're highly slanted toward the defense, but they don't follow the law,
well,
a little problem.
Well, we won, and there's no prejudice to the defendant, so that would be my position. In spite of all that...
There would be no prejudice to the defendant if the instructions did not follow the law.
If the instructions were... I'm not saying that they didn't exactly follow the law. The instructions were so slanted. I think that is true. If the jury is going to say, they are going to think, do the mitigating circumstances outweigh the aggravating circumstances? Are they equal? Can I make up my mind? There's no reason why they can't go through all those things, and they are given the instruction of repeatedly in these instructions more than, there are several times, and I can go through, I've marked them in the transcript, where they were told that they could only return a death verdict if they found that the aggravating circumstances outweighed the mitigating circumstances beyond reasonable doubt. And I think these instructions were highly beneficial to the defense. And I think, and the bottom line is that this case was not aggressively prosecuted, in my opinion. I do not see if a prosecutor, particularly Mr. Craven's part, and Ms. Shreve, I think, might have been more aggressive than he was, but this was pretty much a bare bones prosecution for a death penalty case, and I think that that goes through with allowing the defense counsel to handle whatever instructions that he wants in the penalty phase, and that's how I read that. I realize that, quite frankly, it makes
sense. I mean, moving on to something else that we're supposed to consider, and that is the proportionality of the application of the death penalty. This is not the most egregious fact pattern.
The safety bit is
Franklin County prosecutor's face in terms of bringing to that case. And if I recall correctly, relatives of the victim testified that they were asking for death.
The mother, the religious people, and I think that at some point they, after jury returned its verdict, that they did that. And
I mean, so could it be that nobody quite had a part in this because they weren't quite sure this ought to be a death case in the first place?
Mr. Sherman, in his closing argument, said this wasn't the crime of the century. And in appellate's brief, appellate counsel said at one point, and I don't have the page of their brief, where they said that this is not a particularly heinous crime. And, and you may agree with that.
So why go for the death penalty?
It does fit the statute, and you're talking about, I think it was a particularly egregious crime. And here was this young man. He was out with his sister, and somebody comes to him in a parking lot with a loaded gun, says, give me what you're wearing around your neck. I think that's egregious. It might not be lurid. It might not be spectacular. It might not have stuff that tabloids are interested in, but it's a horrible crime. And I think the bottom line in this case is that there was almost no mitigating evidence. I think the court was generous in allowing some weight to what this man had. He had a bad childhood.
Well, but every purposeful killing is a horrible crime.
That's right.
And
aggravated robbery is an aggravated circumstance. And this was a strange crime. This was, he just saw that he was wearing gold chains out of his neck, around his neck. He took him, he killed him. That's a value judgment. I mean, I'm not going to criticize anybody who feels the way about it or how they want to describe it, but it seems to me that it certainly fits the statute, and I think it's a crime that merits the death penalty if anyone does. I mean, this was a stranger to him. He did nothing to him. All he did was wear a gold chain around his neck that the defendant wanted. And I have problems with anybody who wants to diminish with the concept that this crime should be diminished based on his facts.
And he's hanging out at an after-hours bar.
That's a social club. That's where people hang out. That's a cultural thing. Condra Weber testified that she had no idea that it was illegal. I mean, she knew it was the mother's owner. Maybe he did. Who knows? He's not here to tell us. But that is a social thing. I mean, the police kind of close their eyes to them. The people go there, the neighborhood people, you can tell that they've hung out. It might be similar to the people who hang out at the jury room by the courthouse. Something like this could happen to any one of us where if we went to a place, to a restaurant or to a concert or to a theater, we were in the parking lot, going back to our cars, whatever. It's not, I don't see a big difference from that. I don't think that the fact that he was in an after-hours bar means that he should... And with respect...
I want to get you to Proposition Law 7 at some point.
Oh, you want to get me there? Okay.
Yeah, I sure do.
I want to go there.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you don't.
Two of us want you to go there. You probably better go there.
Okay. I agree Criminal Rule 24 was violated. I think that it was probably appropriate for the alternates to be...
Appropriate.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
The rule is mandatory, is it not?
Yes, it is.
Okay. And now,
I think an exception has been made during when they're deliberating on the guilt phase. I see no reason why they should have gone back during the penalty phase.
Okay, you think there's been an exception during the penalty phase? What exception? The Hutton case.
Yeah.
All right. And in Hutton, the jury deliberated, the constituted jury deliberated in the guilt phase, and then somebody got sick, and the judge substituted an alternate juror into the penalty phase. And the Chief Justice took great pains in saying that, in fact, this substitution was proper, and the reason it was proper is because they really didn't have to hear, although they did, in the guilt phase, what they needed to judge in the penalty phase. And he likened it to a case in a sister state involving a bifurcated mental question. My question to you is that if you concede that the criminal rule is mandatory and it was violated, what else is there to talk about?
I think there needs to be talked about plain error, and I think you need to go to the U.S. Supreme Court case, Orlando. I don't think that there is a showing that there has been any prejudice to the defendant by the virtue of this. He acquiesced in it. The court gave an instruction. He agreed that it was all right. Now, why, I don't know. But I think that the court has to find that the verdict would have been otherwise based on the circumstances that exist in this case.
So a clear error of law committed by a trial court, regardless of whether a defendant objects, when it's a trial court's job to protect the defendant's rights, is not going to be a case for a reversal. Recently, in a case of Koch or Cook, K-O-C-H versus Rist, a civil case, we said in part, in the concurring opinion as well, that Civil Rule 47C states in part, an alternate juror who does not replace a regular juror shall be discharged after the jury retires to consider its verdict. Therefore, we said that didn't happen. The judge let the alternate juror go into the jury room, and he was right in declaring a mistrial. We said that in a civil case. How much more efficacious must that be when I call your attention that the rule in 24, the wording in 24, is exactly identical to the civil rule?
Right.
How much more efficacious is this a criminal case where the defendant's rights are supposed to be protected by the court?
Your Honor, in the civil case, you were also upholding the decision of the trial court. And I still believe that unjudged error has to be reviewed on a plain error standard, whether or not there was prejudice to the defendant. And this Supreme Court did address this issue in Orlando and said that where there was acquiescence and where there was an instruction, they did not find plain error. And I don't know how a plain error otherwise would have affected the outcome of the trial.
That's U.S. Supreme Court case does not prohibit us from having a stricter rule in Ohio.
No, of course not.
Nor does it interpret the language of the Ohio rule.
But we would have, what your argument is, counsel, the standard of review for plain error is well established. And that's the point that you're saying. It has to be outcome determinative. We have a lot of error in this court, but we only judge whether prejudicial error is what we look for.
Yeah. know, thank you.
Sure.
Going back to the instruction, I would just like to iterate, unless there, if there are no further questions on that, but there was really very little mitigating evidence that this defendant had to present.
You really haven't addressed the ineffective assistance of counsel issue. The overall, because if we do not find a plain error, then we can look at ineffective assistance of counsel with the result in this case, because of the non-objections with the result in this case being different.
Are we talking about the jury instructions, or are we talking about
everything? Everything that the defense has argued is ineffective assistance of counsel.
As I said before, there was very...
You simply have to address whether in ineffective assistance of counsel you look at the result of the trial.
In order to find ineffective assistance of counsel, you have to find that the attorney made errors, and you also must find prejudice. So I consider it to be equivalent to a plain error standard, that you must find that the result of the trial might be different. And in this particular case, I don't believe that that the jury instructions that he requested fall to that level. What we're talking about, there was in fact no instruction on the statutory mitigating factors, and I believe that this was to the defendant's benefit, because he had so little to put into litigation. He had an absent well father, that's not particularly unusual. He had a mother who worked two jobs, who was emotionally cold, and spent her evenings drinking. He went to school regularly until he was 8th grade, I believe. There were efforts in the community to help him when he was in his mid-teens. He was sent to Job Corps training. During his year there, he refused to do anything. And he slept in their beds, he ate their food, he just did nothing. And after a year, just left and came back to live with his grandmother, to live with his mother, to sell drugs on the street. There's no evidence that he did anything from the time he was 16 that could be considered as mitigating anything in his nature, history, or background from that period on, from the 10 years before the commission could be mitigating. So therefore, I say an instruction requests that to the jury that you may consider anything that you've heard, whether or not the attorneys bring it up or not, whatever is in your mind, the mitigating circumstances. Clearly that's wrong, but to this defendant it's beneficial. With respect to, if there are more questions on that, with respect to a statement, there are two issues here, whether or not he initially intelligently and voluntarily waived his right to remain silent, and whether, whether he unambiguously and unequivocally invoked his right to remain silent sometime into the interview, and they're separate. Whether or not a defendant has waived his right to remain silent is an issue that's determined by the totality of the circumstances. And I submit to you that this defendant did initially, voluntarily, and intelligently, and knowingly waive his right to remain silent. And there was a correction of my brief in Appellant's reply brief, where I said that the detective read the waiver form to Appellant, and that is inaccurate. The detective went through preliminary matters addressing his rights. The detective read his rights to him while the defendant stood at the table and read silently. And then the detective handed the form to him and asked him to read the waiver portion to him, and the defendant did. He said, the defendant asked him what that meant to him, and he said, it means I can talk if I want to. The detective then went into an explanation as to why he wanted to talk to him, he was arrested, blah, blah, blah. He said to him, you don't have to talk to me, I can't advise you to talk or not talk. And in response to that, the defendant just went in to saying, I was there, I left, and I don't know anything about it, I just heard about it later. It was, he didn't really even give the detective a chance to ask him to sign the waiver or to ask him any of his questions. He just went into explaining, or into a denial of why he was there, and I think that's a pretty clear indication that he wanted to talk, that he wanted to deny. And I think that based on his intelligence, his age, watching the videotape, this does not strike me as an intelligent young man. I mean, he seemed to be a very capable person, based on the fact that before the police officer even asked him a question about the offense, he went into his denial, indicated that he wanted to talk to them, he wanted to deny, and that was a knowing and voluntary waiver of his right to remain silent. Then subsequently, you have a statement later on, and I believe, I'm drawing a blank here as how long, but I think maybe 20 minutes into the interview, and I could be wrong. Detective Gates, the first detective, said that he was finished, he wanted to go ask his partner something. And the defendant said, I'm ready to quit talking now too, I'm ready to go home too. And the detective said, well, I'm just going to go ask him, he went outside. Now, at the suppression hearing, and it's really irrelevant what their understanding was, the issue was whether or not the defendant invoked his right to remain silent at that point. And I don't see that as he did. First of all, it was mumbled, it wasn't real forceful or definitive. He certainly didn't bring it up later on. And I would agree that they were out of the room 2 minutes later. They were out of the room for 2 minutes. They came back in, and he did not raise that issue with them again, say that he did not want to talk. And at 2 points, Detective Yates told him that he didn't have to talk to them at all. And before, you know, and obviously Yates was setting him up for this interview, but 20 minutes after that, 11:18:20 in the tape, Detective Yates told him, if you were planning on shooting, if this was your plan, don't tell us that. You don't want to talk to us about that. So clearly, the defendant was aware of what his rights were. He weighed them, and his comment, when the Detective Yates was completely finished with his part of the interview, was not so unambiguous that you could take it to be an indication of his right to remain silent.
You're all finished now? I want to go back to the juror thing, because I just didn't want to interrupt your argument. Why do you suppose, among other things, the judge said to the alternate jurors, you run back into the juror room, but do not participate in the deliberations in any fashion, even by gestures or facial movements? Why do you suppose the judge went that far?
I suppose that she felt that she was protecting her record, that was jurors follow the instructions and that would do.
That the rule was being violated.
I don't know.
That's pretty extraordinary precaution, isn't it? That's pretty extraordinary precaution. You ever seen that charge before? I never have.
Specifically, I think I could see things that were similar to that.
Wouldn't it be an indication that, for the very purpose of the rule, that there's not to be anyone in the jury room when the jury is deliberating other than the jurors? even an alternate juror shouldn't be there because someone else other than a juror could be influencing the decision of the jury? Wouldn't that be the reason the judge would have made that extraordinary sort of statement to the alternate? It's more than protecting a record, isn't it, to try to be sure that I'm letting you go in even though you shouldn't be in the room, and so I'm giving you this admonition. Don't do anything from which a juror, a real juror, could take some influence. And isn't that the very reason that the alternate juror should not have been there? The reason the rule is what it is.
I agree with that.
So supposing that the judge had let a dispatch reporter go into the jury room and the defendant didn't object. Did you say that was error?
Yes, Your Honor.
Are the alternate jurors any different than the dispatch reporter, given the law, which says nobody in that jury room but jurors?
That's true, Your Honor. But even so, even if it were a dispatch reporter, I think that you would still have to show, under the circumstances where everybody agreed, they would have to be showing that they were included.
Oh, that's what I was asking. You're saying that if a dispatch reporter's in the jury room, the defendant then has to show the outcome of the trial would have been different if he didn't object.
I believe so, yeah.
Are there not some duties that the judge has to control the process of a trial that are so fundamental that a party who loses should not have to convince judges or someone that error by the judge was not prejudicial or was prejudicial? Are there any acts of a judge that you think could just per se be prejudicial, or at least we deem them to be prejudicial, so against the system that we would call for reversal?
I'm not able right in this moment, but yes, I would agree with that.
Isn't the jury, the deliberation of the jury, we put so much faith in the jury system in our country, so much faith in citizens being jurors, that wouldn't the sanctity of that jury room be when the deliberations are occurring, that very critically important decision being made? Wouldn't that be a time when the judge should be in total control of the situation? Don't rely upon the lawyers to say, well, you made a mistake, judge. But isn't that a fundamental right that somebody has to have a jury that is in a jury room without any influences from anyone else, even unintended influences? Would that not be one of those sort of fundamental, not constitutional right, but sort of a basic right that someone has to expect from the judge?
Your Honor, I believe that the court did try to protect their rights by instructing the jury as instructed them. And we have no notification that the jurors did not follow her instructions.
And shown them the very rules.
That they didn't worry about the deliberations in any way. If there are no further questions, I think we're talking now.
Oh, God. Mr. Edward, you saved a little over a minute of your time.
May it please the Court again, I would like to just make three quick points in response. First off, on pages 53 and 54 of Volume 1 of our brief, we do cite several cases which deals with this issue of violation of Criminal Rule 24. Now, it's not in Ohio cases, it doesn't deal with Ohio Rule 24, but apparently there are some courts of appeals on the federal level, U.S. versus Virginia, Erection Court, which is a Fourth Circuit case from 1964, as well as U.S. versus D.C., which take a position that having alternates is presumptive error, that it violates the secrecy of jury deliberation process, and it's probably equivalent to having strangers back there. In fact, I think Justice Douglas, your question dealing with whether it's, would it have any difference if it was a dispatch reporter, we would agree it would have no difference. It deals with the fundamental right to a jury trial to have the jury deliberate in secrecy. And again, the problem here is that it would be almost impossible for the defense at any point to even show prejudicial error, which, as we argue on the bottom of page 53, this is why these courts have reached this position, because it puts the defense in a position that it would be nearly impossible to show it. So it would almost be presumptive error. The other two points I'd like to make is that on page 1576 of volume 2, I see my time's up. Thank you very much.
I have a question for you. Do you think that the rule does not permit the trial judge to exercise discretion in the manner in which the trial judge exercised discretion here, and in the interest of, let's say, judicial economy? Death cases take a long time. They're very expensive. They take a long time to argue or to try. Trial judge decides, well, one of those jurors could become ill during the deliberations, and so I'm going to let the alternate juror go in and instruct the alternate juror. Now, here are the rules. You can go in the room, but no speaking, no gesturing, nothing. You have to be like the wall. What in the rule says that the trial judge may not do that?
Well, I'm not sure if Mr. Chief Justice, I'm not sure if there's a specific rule. I guess I would just fall back upon the whole concept of the type of case we're dealing with. Whether it's this court saying it or whether it's the U.S. Supreme Court and all the great landmark death penalty cases, where the court's coming against it, the death is different. We're talking about a life-and-death situation. We're dealing with my client, Murphy, who's on death row. And granted, there has to be this delicate balancing. There has to be a balancing. Sure, there's judicial economy. Courts are busy in every county, especially in Franklin County. But when you're dealing with a life-and-death decision that this jury's making, it would seem that when you're conducting that balance, that it has to endure to the benefit of the person who's facing a potential of being placed in a high death row. So it would seem to me that I don't have any alternatives at this point, but it would just seem to me that what took place in this case, I think you can think Justice Douglas has kind of brought me around a bit. It seems what happened here is a fundamental violation of the secrecy of the jury deliberation process. And this in and of itself would necessitate a retrial in this matter.
Thank you, Mr. Edwards. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.